and ended up killing someone. I could have easily been with him, and either ended up in jail as he did, as an accomplice, or, heaven forbid, been shot myself. Such was the world I was living in, which was why I was more than content to stay home and play board games with my brothers and sisters while everybody else was partying at all hours of the night. Not going to the parties or the dances at school set me further apart socially, but it was a price I was willing to pay. Besides, getting to bed early made it easy for me to be the first one at the gym the following morning, and nothing was more important. At the same time, I wasn't exactly a monk. I was a man, with certain needs, if you know what I mean. Her name was Rosalind, and we could not have had less in common. She was a senior. I was a sophomore. She was part of the in-group. I wasn't part of any group. She'd had boyfriends before. I'd never been in a relationship. What we did have in common was being tall. She was 6 foot and slim, and we were both virgins. Not that I was thrilled about the second part. Every night since I was about 14, I'd gone to sleep wondering, when am I going to get laid? It could not happen soon enough. Remember, I hung around kids who were having sex before they were learning how to drive. I had not even been to first base. So when a friend told me about a gorgeous girl with short dark hair who had just broken up with her boyfriend and was asking about me, I made my move. I don't recall what I said, but knowing how shy I was around girls, I'm sure it couldn't have been very smooth. Whatever it was, it worked. Rosalind and I exchanged numbers, and before long we were going steady, as they used to say. Though her idea of going steady was a little unusual. Day after day, I'd follow her down the hall, but she'd always walk a couple of steps in front and never wait for me to catch up. Whether it had to do with the difference in our status in school, I couldn't be certain. But I didn't have the nerve to ask her to slow down. I also didn't have the nerve to be more passionate, and she wasn't pleased. I'd give her a peck on the cheek, but that was about it. "We should be kissing to the point where I don't have any lipstick on by the time we're done," she told a friend of ours. One day, finally, I kissed her like she wanted to be kissed, and she didn't complain ever again. By junior year, whenever Rosalind made the short trip home from Columbia, where she attended college, we'd hang out at my house or hers. You can guess what happened next. And when she got pregnant, there was not any doubt we'd keep the baby. Nor was there any doubt we'd get married. That was simply what one did in the South in the early 1990s. And truth is, I was looking forward to it. Rosalind and I loved each other. Why not share our love with a child? I would still have to get through high school and then hopefully college. No one in my family had earned a college degree. And that meant more to my mom than anything. "Take care of your education," she assured me, and she would help take care of the baby. Still, I was terrified. Who in my situation wouldn't be? The day would come, and soon, when that child would be my responsibility. And I knew nothing about being a father or raising a family. I was critical of some of the choices my father made, but I hadn't been dealing with the pressures he faced. Perhaps there was a lot more to being the head of a household than I thought. Helping me cope with these fears, in addition to the assurances from my mother, was the faith I gained from being around the military. I don't presume for a second to have been familiar with what went on in the minds of those who put their lives on the line. But seeing how they handle themselves, I came to realize that, as long as you have a pulse, you should be able to deal with any obstacle. Knowing that I would have a child to support forced me to focus more on my future. It wouldn't be only about me anymore. My lone regret is that I wasn't there to see the birth of our daughter, Tierra, and the fall of my senior year. I had been told Rosalind was in the hospital for a checkup, not that she was in labor. I was in school when Mom came by to give me the news. When I arrived at the hospital and got a first look at my little girl, I was overcome again with the enormity of the task in front of me. I saw Tierra almost every day, Rosalind wanting to make sure she became familiar with her daddy before I left for college. During those first weeks, I was as inept as I feared. I could change her diapers and feed her, but not having spent a great deal of time around babies, I didn't know how to simply sit and play with her. Meanwhile, Mom, as promised, bought the diapers, baby food, milk, and clothing we needed. Given her own finances, this was no small sacrifice. I first saw the Hillcrest basketball coach, James Smith, while I was in junior high. He was always screaming at his players for one reason or another. One time, I kid you not, I watched him throw a ball rack at them. This man is crazy, I thought. I couldn't have been more wrong. In the 3 years I played for Coach Smith, he hardly ever raised his voice. In fact, most of the time he was so quiet, you didn't know he was there. To me, that is one of the highest compliments you can pay a coach. Same with the refs. We should never know their names. The game at any level should be about the players. That's who fans come to see. Coach Smith made sure we were in the best shape possible. We ran 3.1 miles each day after school. That was when I discovered my love and hatred of running. He registered us in cross-country meets in the area, and though we normally got dusted, we were slowly getting used to what it felt like to dig deep within ourselves. In practice, I would occasionally look over at him when he'd blow the whistle to have us run a few laps and think, is he blind? Doesn't he get it that we have nothing left? But we did have something left, and he knew it. We weren't one of the best teams in the state. Not yet. We were still learning how to play with one another, and that takes time. Several of us had been on the same team for 2 years at Ebenezer, but the competition in high school was much fiercer. The biggest accomplishment in my sophomore year was knocking off our main rival, Sumter High. We felt like we had won the state championship. That season, I averaged 20 points and 10 rebounds, but I wasn't aggressive or aware enough of the entire court. That would come later. Meanwhile, being on the team did even more for my image than it did in junior high. Few kids came to the games at Ebenezer, so they usually found out what happened through an announcement over the loudspeaker. The ninth grade boys beat so-and-so, Ray Allen leading the way with 12 points. At Hillcrest, the results were published in the newspaper. A lot of my classmates wanted to be seen with me, and as I became known as a jock, I was once more able to avoid the no-win choice between the whites and the blacks. On the other hand, no matter how much I achieved on the court, and whatever status I helped lend the school, some kids still wouldn't accept me, and that would always be the case. I wasn't one of them, and by them, I mean those who had spent their entire lives in Dalzell. I'll give you a perfect illustration. The whole senior class met in the cafeteria to hand out the awards they give at probably every high school in America. You know, class clown, best couple, most likely to be president, etc. One by one, each student who was named went up to the front to receive a certificate. Everybody applauding. But when they called my name for being the most likely to succeed, the room went dead silent. Considering how well I had played that year, they thought they had no choice but to give me the honor. But that didn't mean they were happy about it. I almost felt like I was doing something wrong by accepting it. People, my teammates included, were always waiting for me to do or say the wrong thing. And when I did, they took advantage. Such as the interview I gave in the cafeteria with a local TV station after I won the State Player of the Week award. Instead of using the word gym, I referred to it as a gymnasium. They got a big chuckle out of that. No one in Dalzell would ever use the word gymnasium. Or the time in a game senior year against West Florence when I grabbed the ball on the opening tip and scored on a reverse tomahawk dunk. All I heard was silence in return. Why aren't the fans going nuts? You can't tell me that wasn't one of the more spectacular dunks you have ever seen. There was a reason. That wasn't our basket, a teammate said. Oops. I was embarrassed, to say the least, and although it made no difference in the outcome, we killed them. I had a feeling I'd hear about that dunk for a long time. I wouldn't be shocked if some of my former teammates still tell the story. Many of them would come over to the house and we'd hang out for a while, but I always sensed a barrier between us, and it wasn't merely because I didn't come from their world. It was also because of my success, and them understanding, as my mother said, that I would get out of there and do something good with my life, and they most likely would not. One teammate fouled me so hard on purpose in practice that I got scratches everywhere and I was bleeding. Another told people that I might receive a college scholarship, but I'd sit on the bench for 4 years and come back to town an alcoholic. It reminded me of Kenny, the kid from junior high who said I would never make the team. It got to the point where I stopped sharing good news, even with those I had assumed cared about me. When my teammate Red, whose real name was Maurice, failed to say a word any time I showed him a recruiting letter I received, I realized it was because the letters from colleges were pouring in for me, but not for him. I decided not to show him or anyone another letter. Red would wind up going to a small university in South Carolina, and we'd lose touch. Moral of the story? Don't get too excited about your success in front of others. Many don't care if you succeed, and quite a few hope you'll fail. Besides, I couldn't waste time on what others might think of me. There was too much work to do. In the summer between 10th and 11th grades, I competed in amateur athletic union, AAU ball, against a number of the top players in Washington, D.C. and Virginia. D.C. in those days was the crossover capital of high school basketball. I had never seen such fancy dribbling anywhere. The best part of AAU was getting a chance to play in big cities and to meet kids from all over South Carolina, including one from Greenville, about 150 miles northwest of Dalzell. The kid was Kevin Garnett. Kevin and I had a mutual friend who picked me up first, then him, and drove us to Columbia to play against guys from the University of South Carolina. The trip took a couple of hours, but that's what you do if you're 16 years old and you want to find out how you match up against players older than you. The two of us got to know each other quite well that summer. "Man, you're like Jordan," Kevin used to say. "Every time he scores 30, you score 35. Believe me, I was no Jordan, but I was clearly a better player my junior year, and the summer in AAU ball was one of the reasons. I found the aggression I didn't have in my sophomore year, and it also had to do with how assertive I had become in my relationship with Rosalind. I was gaining confidence by the day. Our team was also getting better. We knew which plays worked and which ones didn't. Coach Smith let us play. He said less than ever. He was also a huge help with the recruiting letters. Some coaches, when they have a player who is attracting attention from top schools, see the situation as an opportunity for themselves, not just the kid. "You want him to play for you? Fine. You have to take me too. I know the kid." Conversely, if a school doesn't take the coach, the implication is, "I'll make sure the kid goes somewhere else." That wasn't Coach Smith. Did he want to advance in his career? You bet. Except he would advance the right way, and not exploit me or anyone as a bargaining chip. I was so naive, it wasn't until years later when I was a pro that I learned about the deals recruiters routinely made, as they say, under the table, offering cars, women, cash, you name it. No one offered me a dime, and that's probably because they didn't believe I was good enough. The class of 1993 included players a lot more heralded than I was, such as Rasheed Wallace, Jerry Stackhouse, and Jeff McInnes, all of whom would one day play in the NBA. There were times I too wondered if I was good enough, like in the summer after 11th grade when I attended the annual Nike camp in Indianapolis. Seeing a gap between the other players and myself, I realized I couldn't just beat the competition back in South Carolina. I had to dominate. It really hit me when I wasn't selected for the All-Star game near the end of camp, which, I should add, was to be shown on television. I watched the game from the bleachers next to Stephon Marbury, who was only going into 10th grade. "Yo," Stephon said, "I saw you play all week. You're better than they are." "What am I supposed to do?" I told him. "Run down to the floor and tell them to put me in?" From the look on his face, that's exactly what he thought I should do. Little could either of us have imagined that in 4 years' time, he and I would be back-to-back picks in the NBA draft and be traded for each other the same night. We hadn't made it to college yet. I left Indianapolis more dedicated than ever. As a senior, I was the Gatorade Player of the Year in South Carolina, averaging 28 points, 13 rebounds, and 6 assists. I even was given a nickname, Candyman, from a coach who was also the public address announcer. "Everything you do is so sweet," he told me. Word traveled fast, especially in a small state like ours. Since our gym seated about only 650, people would squeeze in the side door and stand up the whole time. They came to find out for themselves if I was as good as they had been told. First, they had to find out who I was, period. This was years before the internet, where your face is everywhere. I'd be warming up before a game when I'd overhear fans searching for me. "That's him over there." "No, it's not. That other guy is Ray Allen." "You're wrong. He's the one by the free throw line." I preferred to have the attention on the team, not on me. We deserved it. By this point, we were among the finest in the state. Besides playing together since 8th grade, some of my teammates and I competed in the games at Shaw and on courts near my house. As we got taller, I was now 6'5", while the others were 6'3 or 6'2". We learned to play above the rim, practicing at first with a volleyball, which we could palm, before moving on to the real thing. Every so often, we'd face a team with a player who was 6'8 or 6'9", but it was never anybody who could take over a game. We were simply more athletic than everybody else. In one of our set plays, I'd throw the ball to Ronnie Morant, who we called T on the block, and dart down the lane. He'd toss it high in the air, and I'd slam it home. The other team knew what was coming but couldn't stop it. Sometimes teams didn't know what was coming. We had this one trick play where it appeared that T would be the inbounds passer, but as soon as the ref handed him the ball, I'd say loud enough for the guy guarding me to hear, "I'm supposed to take the ball out." The defender would relax for an instant, and that was all I needed. T would hit me as I cut to the hoop for an easy dunk. We went 27-4 during the regular season and kept the momentum going in the playoffs, which were held at Morris College in Sumter. In the state championship game against James F. Burns on the University of South Carolina campus, we grabbed a 40-14 lead in the first half and began to celebrate prematurely. With only a few minutes to go, the lead was down to single digits. To this day, I don't know how they came back. Fortunately, I nailed a couple of jumpers and made a dunk to seal it for us. I finished with 25 points and 15 rebounds. We were the state champions. One would think winning the title would make us heroes in Dalzell, then and forever. Not so. No parade, no keys to the city, nothing. That said everything one needed to know about the differences between high school basketball and football in the South. Win the state in football, you're a legend. Basketball took such a backseat that we had to take up collections to buy uniforms and shoes and to go on road trips. Yet I wasn't bitter. If anything, I was grateful for my years in South Carolina. grateful for discovering the courage I wasn't sure I had, and, of course, for the woman I fell in love with and the girl we were raising together. In California, I could do little wrong, but in South Carolina, I came to realize there would always be people testing me, and the question was, would I become what some hoped I would be, a failure, or would I hope to be, a winner, on and off the court? That's the challenge facing all of us, to overcome the doubts others have about us, and the doubts we ourselves have. I changed in South Carolina for good, and for the better. 4. Go North, young man. The first letters came junior year from small schools, mostly in the South. Furman, Liberty, Mercer, Winthrop, East Carolina, Campbell University, UNC Charlotte, and East Tennessee State. I was thrilled to open every one of them, no matter the size or prestige of the school. Barring any mishaps during my senior year at Hillcrest, I would be going to college, and that was something I never took for granted. Most of the kids I played with in high school would have given anything for one letter, from anywhere. Going to college would also mean I could think of a career in the NBA. Sure, the idea had been in the back. Okay, the front of my mind for years, ever since the day I saw Michael Jordan on TV against the Knicks. But it seemed closer to fantasy than reality. Think about it. No one from Dalzell, South Carolina, had ever made it to the NBA. Why would I, Walter Ray Allen Jr., the son of an Air Force technician, be any different? I had been too busy, in any case, with each step along the way, to get ahead of myself. I have long believed that if you focus too much on the next level, you will not succeed at the current level. Give your very best in the situation you're in, and the rest will take care of itself. Of the schools I heard from, I was most intrigued by UNC Charlotte, the 49ers, who seemed more interested in me than the others were. So what if it wasn't a top-tier program? The 49ers competed against a lot of quality teams, which would give me the exposure I was looking for, and there was no reason if I performed well enough I couldn't go from there to the NBA. That's what Cedric Maxwell, who played for the Boston Celtics in the 1970s and 80s, did. I also liked the city. Charlotte was far enough away, roughly 100 miles, that I would feel I was on my own, yet close enough for friends and family to visit. I could definitely see myself going there. Besides, I did not expect to hear from the bigger colleges. No one in Dalzell did. In football, yes. Basketball? Never. I was wrong. Not long afterward, I heard from one major school after another. Wake Forest, Virginia, Southern Cal, Villanova, and so on. Then I was really excited. I put each letter in a large treasure chest that belonged to my dad. The chest was a time capsule for me. I knew even then there would be a lot of ups and downs through the years, but whatever happened, I would always have the chest to remind me of this special time in my life. There were occasions, I must admit, when it was overwhelming. Wake Forest sent me a letter almost every day, and not just about their basketball team. They sent articles about other teams to show that I would be a part of the entire university community. After a while, I stopped reading them. Some letters seemed to have been written by someone who had attended one of my games. The details were specific, and the sentiments personal. Others felt like they'd been written by a secretary in a coach's office who wouldn't be able to tell the difference between Ray Allen and Ray Alston. It reminds me of the guys, and you know the type, who hit on a dozen different girls at the same time. One is bound to go out with them. I've forgotten some of the schools that wrote or called, but there was one call I will never forget. "You're a hell of a player," Dean Smith said. Yes. Dean Smith, the coach at North Carolina. No figure in the sport was more revered than he was. I want you to know I think you'll have a great career, he went on. We're not recruiting you because we have someone on our roster at your position. If we didn't, we would definitely be interested in you. I wish you the best of luck. If that wasn't the epitome of class, I don't know what is. And he didn't need me. The someone Coach Smith was referring to was Jerry Stackhouse, who would go on to be a star for the Tar Heels. Come senior year, the clock was ticking, and I had to narrow my choices down to 5. That is the maximum number of official visits the NCAA allows you to make, and I was not going to commit myself to 4 years at a place I never saw in person. 2 schools I hoped to put in the final 5 were Clemson and UCLA. I fell in love with Clemson when I went to a basketball camp there one summer, and I was a Bruins fan during our years in California. With the 10 national championships won by John Wooden in the 1960s and 70s, no program was more successful than theirs. As a kid, I walked everywhere wearing a blue and gold Bruins hat and jersey. Neither made the list. Clemson was out because the Tigers were likely to go on probation, and I couldn't take a risk. UCLA was out because the Bruins apparently weren't in need of my services. I never heard a word from them. Early on, another possibility was Virginia. I was impressed by the coach, Jeff Jones, who wanted to play an up-tempo style, and the school was a member of the Atlantic Coast Conference, which had North Carolina and Duke. You can't get better exposure than the ACC. One day, though, out of nowhere, I received a letter stating that the Cavs were no longer recruiting me, as they had signed somebody else with a similar skill set. A place I didn't consider was the University of South Carolina. No doubt I would have given it serious thought, but like UCLA, there were no letters or phone calls, which was surprising since I was one of the best players in the state. Not until months later did the coaches reach out, and that was only because the school had failed to bring on other players it was recruiting and was under pressure from the local press. Too late. I had made up my mind. The final 5 were Alabama, Wake Forest, North Carolina State, Kentucky, and the University of Connecticut. During my junior year, before I settled on those 5, one coach after another came to our house saying all the right things to Mom and me. Dad was still in Korea. She didn't pretend to know everything about the game of basketball or the world of academia, but she knew how to listen and ask good questions, and that was just as important. Dad offered his opinion on the phone, but there was little he could do that far away. You need to determine how sincere the coaches are, and the best way was to look them in the eye. They are no different than any traveling salesman. Do I wish that Dad could have been more involved in the recruiting process from start to finish? Absolutely. What teenage boy wouldn't want his father to help him make such a potentially life-defining choice? At the same time, because I was often on my own, I'd learned to be independent and trust my instincts. They rarely let me down. Fortunately, in addition to Coach Smith, one of the football coaches at Hillcrest offered some advice. "Where do you think I should go to college?" I asked him. "I would never tell you where to go," he responded. "That's different," I told myself. No one had hesitated to tell me before, and they knew a heck of a lot less about college than the football coach did. Then came the message that resonated. "Whatever you do," he said, "make sure that you make the decision." I know it seems obvious, but too many kids allow somebody else, a parent, girlfriend, agent, coach, etc., anybody except themselves, to make the decision. Listen to those close to you, I tell kids these days. They might see something you don't. Yet always keep in mind that their goals are not necessarily the same as yours. You're the one who will go to classes and take exams. You're the one who must get along with your coaches and teammates. You're the one who will earn a degree or won't. And you're the one who will look back with pride or regret. I saw some phenomenal players in high school who should have been stars in college and maybe in the NBA, but they chose what turned out to be the wrong school for them and weren't heard from again. In October 1992, a week after Tierra was born, I made my first visit to the University of Alabama. I spent 2 days in Tuscaloosa, and they were two of the best days I can remember. One of my hosts was Marvin Orange, a freshman point guard from the Columbia area who had been the best high school player in the state. I didn't know Marvin, though I knew a lot about him. Seeing somebody from my part of the world fit in as well as he did, I thought Alabama could very well be the place for me. On my first night, I went to what's known as a step show, where members of different fraternities and sororities gather in a large auditorium to perform a series of dance steps to a hip-hop beat in the background, everyone chanting along. It suddenly dawned on me. This was what I'd been dreaming about since I was 12 and saw School Days, the movie about students at a black college. They were having a blast, and I couldn't wait to join them. The following day, I went to a football game. Of course I did. On no campus in America was football bigger than at Alabama, where the coach for many years, Paul William Bear Bryant, was more well-known than the governor, and the Pope as well, if I'm not mistaken. The Crimson Tide, as usual, rolled over South Carolina, 48-7. Yet, as much fun as I was having, two things happened during my visit that made me question whether Alabama was the place for me after all. One incident occurred before lunch in Birmingham on the day I arrived. We stopped there to meet another recruit before going to campus. I got out of the car and was walking toward the restaurant when I made eye contact with the driver of a pickup truck. He stuck out his middle finger. "He can't possibly be mad at me," I told myself. "I didn't do anything wrong." I didn't have to do anything wrong. I was black, he was white, and we were in Alabama. That was wrong enough. I went inside, had a nice lunch, and didn't tell anyone. I didn't see the point. There was nothing another player or a coach could have done about the guy in the truck. I'd have to decide for myself if I could live with that amount of racism around me, because it wasn't about to go away. The other incident took place at the football game. As a prized recruit, I figured I'd get a decent seat, perhaps close to the 50-yard line. I didn't get any seat at all. I was forced to stand in the aisle the whole time. The basketball coaches didn't have a lot of clout, or they didn't think I was important enough. Either way, I was concerned I'd be going to a school where, once again, basketball ranked far below football. Still, I didn't take Alabama out of the running. As a matter of fact, "You had a great time, didn't you?" said Greg Polinski, an assistant coach, before I headed back to South Carolina. "Yes, I had a great time," I admitted. "Alabama is the only place for you," Coach Polinski added. Then, using what he knew about my situation at home, he made his closing argument. He was clearly a pro at this. "You have to start making mature decisions," he told me. "You've got a daughter to take care of. You have to tell me you want to come here." I don't have to tell him a thing, I thought. Yet he kept going on and on about why I had to choose Alabama. Finally, I gave in. I didn't want to let him down. Not surprisingly, the moment I got back to Dalzell, people told me I was crazy for making such a rash decision. The football coach who had given me great advice before put it best. "You may love Alabama, and in the end, that very well might be the best place for you," he said. "But how are you going to know unless you see what else is out there?" I knew he was right before he finished his sentence. I had four more visits I could make, and that was what I would do. Forget about not wanting to let down the Alabama coach. This was my future, not his. He didn't take it well. I felt he'd been trying to manipulate me by saying how mature I needed to be to raise my child. Now he told me how immature I was because I had the nerve to visit other colleges. He also mentioned There was somebody else Alabama was recruiting, and if he signed, he later did, there would not be a spot for me. Nice try. It didn't work. This is what I have to do, I told Coach Polinsky. If that's who you want, do what you have to do. I shouldn't be too critical. The man was trying to succeed in an intensely competitive business, and when you consider the sleazy way some recruiters behave, his tactics were pretty mild. I agreed to one compromise. I would visit only two of the four schools, Kentucky and Connecticut. It was a mistake, I know, but it showed again how young and vulnerable I was. The University of Connecticut was next. Connecticut? What would ever possess me to put that school in the Final Five? A big-name coach? Nope. A big-time tradition? Not exactly. A big-city environment? Please. What then? Decency, integrity, honesty. I remember the first time I heard from them. On the phone was Howie Dickenman, one of their assistant coaches, who had watched me at an AAU tournament in Jacksonville. That day, he put a P next to my name. P short for potential. I'm from UConn, Coach Dickenman told me during the call. I'm very interested in recruiting you. I was confused. UConn? Wait a minute. Isn't that near Alaska? I said. I'm not kidding. I thought he was calling from the Yukon Territory. I didn't know they played basketball up there. After we got a chuckle out of that, the coach and I enjoyed a wonderful chat. I don't recall exactly what he said, but there was something about his raspy northeastern accent that assured me he could be trusted. He and the other Connecticut coaches, I could tell, didn't believe in BS. How refreshing. I'd heard enough already from other recruiters. At Alabama, for example, they said I would go from there right to the NBA. I appreciated their faith in me, but no one is guaranteed a future at the next level. The UConn coaches, on the other hand, said nothing about the NBA. They didn't even make promises about my freshman year. We'll give you the opportunity to be as successful as you want, they explained, but it's up to you how much work you put in. Those were precisely the words I wanted to hear. It had been up to me to put in the work at Ebenezer, at Shaw, at Hillcrest, in the AAU games, and if I went to UConn and I wasn't successful, at least I would know I'd been given a fair shot. You can't ask for anything more. After my conversation with Coach Dickenman, I did some research of my own. Before then, I had known little about the school, and what I did know did not make me fond of the place. That's because in the 1990 NCAA Tournament East Regional Semifinals, UConn defeated my beloved Clemson Tigers on a miracle jump shot by Tate George at the buzzer. I was devastated. 2 days later in the final, UConn lost a heartbreaker of its own to Duke, Christian Laettner hitting a jumper as time ran out. Justice served, in my opinion. I could tell it was on the rise, even if it had yet to make an appearance in a Final Four, let alone win a national championship. Under Jim Calhoun, who took over as the coach in 1986, the Huskies were 118-73, a more than respectable record, especially in a conference as competitive as the Big East. Connecticut, as you'd expect, did some research of its own as well. Coach Calhoun came over to our house and watched a game at Hillcrest. Safe to say it wasn't one of my better performances. I scored just 9 points, though it wasn't the other team that held me back. It was my own. Hoping to get noticed themselves and harm my chance to get a scholarship, my teammates would not pass the ball to me. Mom was beside herself. Good thing for them she stayed in her seat. Her nickname was Truck, in case you forgot. I calmed her down afterward. Mom, if I'm good, nothing can hold me back. I knew I'd get more opportunities at tournaments during the summer, and as I said before, there's a lot more to the game than scoring. Coach Calhoun would pay attention to everything I did on the court, and I was confident he'd still want me to join his program. If only I could decide what I wanted. That would depend on whether I liked the place when I went for a visit. As it turned out, I loved the place. I loved the state of Connecticut, the town of stores, the campus itself, everything. I showed up on a typically gorgeous fall weekend, the leaves of many different colors. On Friday, I sat in on some classes the players attended. I thought that it was so cool they hung out together away from the court. I didn't connect in the same way with my teammates in high school. Lots of times, remember, they went off to school dances while I was more comfortable staying home. On Saturday, I attended another football game. Granted, football in Stores, Connecticut was nothing like football in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. The Huskies would wind up 5-6 that season. No matter. I had a seat this time, on the 50-yard line, no less, and when I got back to South Carolina, I found out that a photo of me at the game had appeared in the school paper in Stores, and I hadn't even made my decision yet. The moment that meant the most to me occurred while I was in a bar with several of the guys, and the song Woolly Bully came on. One player, who was black, started to sing along with the white players. I was blown away that he knew the lyrics and that he didn't refuse to listen to the song because it wasn't rap. There didn't seem to be the same racial barrier I was used to in South Carolina. This was the place for me. Sound familiar? It should. That's exactly what I said after my visit to Alabama, even after the guy gave me the finger, and after I had to stand in the aisle at the football game. I was getting a bit concerned. Was this how I was going to feel after every school I saw? That's when I knew I had to make the one last visit to Lexington, Kentucky. As much as I loved Connecticut, I needed to be sure. Besides, Kentucky was not just any school. Under Adolph Rupp, the Wildcats won 4 national championships in the 1940s and 50s. Now led by Rick Pitino, another coach making a name for himself, Kentucky was back among the elite just a few years after going on probation for academic and recruiting violations. I met Coach Pitino earlier that year, when he came to our house. The man knew how to sell himself and his program better than anyone. I felt special, wanted. Too bad I didn't feel the same once I got to Lexington, especially when you consider how I was treated in Stores. 2 examples stand out. I was having lunch with the team's star forward, Jamal Mashburn, and his roommate at a restaurant Pitino owned. He happened to be there that afternoon, sitting with some friends a few tables away. Perfect, I figured. He'll stop by for a few minutes to say hello, and I'll learn more to help me make my decision. Only he didn't stop by. He waved, and that was it. It was almost as if we weren't there. Coach Calhoun, it occurred to me, would never have ignored us. He and I, in fact, enjoyed a meal together on my visit to Stores. The second incident took place the next day. I was leaving the dorm and walking to the practice facility when I saw Pitino drive by. He waved again but didn't pull over to chat. I could draw only one conclusion from these 2 similar situations. Go where you are valued, where it's clear somebody wants you to be an essential part of what they're doing. That goes for deciding between colleges, or job offers, or anything. No offense to Pitino, one of the best coaches in college basketball. But to him, I was one of many. If I went to Kentucky, wonderful, he'd find a way to make good use of me. But if not, the program wouldn't suffer one bit. He was accustomed to signing the best high school players in the nation, and that would be true again that year. In any case, I was sure now. Connecticut, here I come. I can't overstate how excited I was. I'd be playing in the Big East, and I used to love watching those epic battles on TV between Georgetown, Syracuse, Villanova, and St. John's. In my opinion, the Big East, not the ACC or Big Ten, was the best conference in the country. I'd also play in Madison Square Garden in New York City, which wasn't known as the Mecca of basketball for nothing. New York, Philly, Boston. I would see all the big cities, and the big cities would mean big stages and big possibilities. I learned that in the summer between 10th and 11th grades during the AAU games in D.C. If I could hold my own in the Big East, I could set my sights on the NBA, and Coach Calhoun would be the perfect man to prepare me for that move. Look what he did for Reggie Lewis, whom he coached at Northeastern in the mid-1980s. Lewis, may he rest in peace, went on to play 6 years for the Boston Celtics, which was quite an accomplishment coming from a college so under the radar. What's more, in choosing Connecticut, I'd received the best of both worlds, playing in the city and going to school in the country, away from the distractions that have kept too many young men from reaching their dreams. I thought of my teammate in high school who told people I'd spend 4 years on the bench and return to Dalzell an alcoholic. I couldn't predict how well I would do at UConn, but he'd be wrong about me. The Connecticut coaches, from the start, cared about me as a human being, not just as a basketball player. Coach Dickinman made sure he knew the names of my brothers and sisters, and to this day he sends Tierra a text every year on her birthday. Dave Leto, another assistant coach, would later open up to me about how much he loved his family. These were grown men who would help me grow. The decision final, I began to spread the word. For the longest time, no one could believe it. Connecticut, they'd say? Why in the world are you going there? I couldn't have shocked them any more if I had said I was going to the moon. I tried to explain my reasoning, but it never seemed to satisfy them. Months later, when Connecticut fell to Jackson State, 90-88 in the first round of the NIT, which is far less prestigious than the NCAA tournament, they let me have it again. Connecticut sucks, they told me. It's going to be different when I get there, I said, and I truly believed it. My father also couldn't understand why I didn't choose Kentucky, and he expressed his displeasure over the phone from Korea. I wasn't in the mood to hear it. You weren't here when Rick Pitino came to the house, I told him. You don't know what the coaches said or what it felt like to sit in those dorm rooms. Are they going to take care of me? You think I should go to Kentucky for no other reason than it's Kentucky? Mom wasn't thrilled either. Earlier in the process, she told me, I don't care where you end up as long as you don't go to Connecticut. I wasn't angry with her, as I was with my dad. She was a mother who didn't want her son to be far away. At the same time, parents, in my view, must always put what's best for their child first. Whether the kid hopes to play in the NBA or be a violinist for the Boston Pops. Rosalind also didn't want me to be far away. The two of us were as tight as ever. I hope I don't come across too insensitive, but how she felt did not factor into the decision for 1 second. I needed to do what I believed was the right thing for my future. Besides, in the long run, the better I did wherever I went, the better I could provide for her and Tierra. I felt a tremendous sense of relief when the recruiting process was over. Not a day had passed in months when someone, a stranger, friend, teacher, family member, anyone, didn't ask where I would be going to college. You will be the first to know, I promise. I could now focus on other concerns, such as trying to make it through my last year of high school. Up to that point, I had avoided any other potential pitfalls that might prevent me from graduating and getting out of that place. That didn't stop me from worrying. Until the last minute, literally. On the morning of graduation, I went with a friend to a practice ceremony at an auditorium in downtown Sumter. Miss practice, they told us, and you won't walk with your class. I even stayed the night before at a house by the arena, where a teammate's sister lived. We didn't want to take any chances. So wouldn't you know it, we got into an accident on the way to the auditorium. A woman born in 1918, that has stuck in my mind for some reason, was the one at fault. But we still had to remain at the scene to fill out a police report, and never made it to the practice. As my friend and I waited for the officers to let us go, my fears got the worst of me. Will this accident keep me from going to the University of Connecticut? From making a life for myself? Get a grip, I told myself. A minor car accident won't keep you from graduating. It just shows you the strange places your mind can go when you want something as badly as I did. Needless to say, I got my diploma. Summer came and went. My 5 years in South Carolina, which sometimes felt like 50, were coming to an end, and I was ready to go. And yet, I wouldn't be the person I am today if I hadn't gone through the struggles I had in those 5 years. It wasn't just about deciding to be a success instead of the failure others said I would be. It had to do with something more important. When I first got to Ebenezer, I took it personally when other black kids criticized me for talking like a white kid. But over time, I realized the problem wasn't me, but them. If I'd let myself believe them, I would have become as angry as they were, and I might have been an angry person for the rest of my life. Now, whenever I run into the type of hatred and ignorance I dealt with 30 years ago, and believe me, like every black person in America, I run into it a lot. It bothers me, but I don't take it personally. I was playing golf several years ago at a course in Connecticut I had gone to many times when a guy I didn't know very well said to me, "How do you like playing the white man's game?" I wasn't shocked, just as I'm not shocked when I walk down the street and hear people lock their car doors because a black man is in the neighborhood. This has happened to me more times than I can ever remember. Just as I'm not shocked when people pay me what they think is a compliment. "You speak so well," or "You have such a great vocabulary." Instead of becoming angry, I try to make a point. "If I were a white person, would you say that to me?" I ask them. There's usually no response. Seeing the look on their face, however, I know I have given them something to think about. But back then, I wasn't so aware of all this. I was only starting to immerse myself in the types of challenges that would befall a young black basketball player. There would be many more to come. 5. What was in stores for me? I showed up on campus early, a week or so before the others. That's always been my habit. Be the first to check out the new scene, and you'll have it down while everyone else is still struggling to find their way. Take practice at UConn, which started at 3:30. I was there at 2:30 at the latest. That gave me time to work on a few things by myself or with a coach. And being there long before you have to be there, I would realize later on, shows how serious you are, which in turn makes the coaches notice. Same goes for arriving at Storrs' campus. In those initial days, I got lost on more than a few occasions, but that was how I got my bearings, and it wasn't long before I felt as if I had been on campus forever. I knew where to eat and shop, and where my classes were. I was determined not to be the typical freshman who stumbles around the first day of class, checking his map over and over. That's not to suggest I didn't have concerns about the new life I was embarking on. On the plane to Hartford, having left behind the three women most dear to me, Rosalind, Tierra, and Mom, I'd sensed for probably the first time how lonely I might be. Perhaps going to school so far away wasn't the smartest decision after all. Fortunately, when I was greeted at the airport by assistant coach Lato, carrying only $200 in my pocket and a trash bag filled with my entire wardrobe because I could not afford a suitcase, any concerns went away. It reminds me of the times I stepped to the free throw line, scared to death I was going to miss. Once the ball was in my hands and I went through my routine, the fear was gone. "I got this," I told myself. One day on campus during those first weeks stands out. There was nothing unusual about the day, really, and come to think of it, that was the point. I woke up around 5:30, lifted weights, took a quick shower, and ate breakfast. Then I did something I had not done before, and I don't recall what inspired me. I put on a tie and sweater, raced out the door, and arrived in plenty of time for my 9 a.m. speech class. "Why are you dressed up?" the girl next to me asked. "Because I'm ready," I said. It took going to class with roughly a dozen other men and women my age, each on a journey of their own, for it to sink in. "This is no dream, Ray. You are a college student. You are in control of your destiny." I worked hard to get to that moment, and yet a part of me had believed it would never happen. Either I'd make some huge mistake like a few guys I knew in high school, or something outside my control would lead to my downfall. A kid our family knew, in fact, who was the top running back in Sumter, was killed in a car accident several months after he was offered a scholarship to Clemson. No longer was it about being the first Allen to make it to college. My sister Kim had enrolled at Benedict College in Columbia the year before, though I did think a lot about all the black people in the history of this country who didn't get an opportunity like this, and the responsibility I now felt to make the most of it, which meant, aside from keeping up with my studies, giving everything I could to the game of basketball, the reason I was able to be there in the first place. The coaches were not kidding when they'd said I'd have to work hard from day one. I'd never trained for basketball before. "I didn't think you had to. You just went out and played." Safe to say, those days were over. They liked to run us, and I mean a lot, which made the cross-country meets I ran in high school seem like Sunday strolls. Most grueling was the route known as Cemetery Hill. It went through a cemetery that we were forced to run every Saturday. No one ever wanted to go on that thing. No one sane, that is. It started with a sharp incline until it leveled off after about a mile. The farther you went, the steeper the incline got. The coaches were messing with our minds, not just our bodies. The first time I saw Cemetery Hill, I didn't think it was a big deal. This was during my visit the year before, and I was in a car with Coach Calhoun watching his players run. "How awesome that they are doing this together," I thought. "Now that's a real team." What I did not know was that it was mandatory. As for Coach Calhoun, think of him as a general on the battlefield. You could almost hear him saying, "Gentlemen, we have an enemy combatant out there, and we got to take him out before he takes us out. Dying is not an option." He knew how to get our attention, that's for sure. In the minutes before practice began, we kept our eyes on the clock on the wall, because when it struck 3:30, and not a minute later, the door would swing wide open, and Coach would come through, pad and pen in his hand. "Guys, we have a lot of work to do," he'd say, every single day. And when he said it, we had better be clapping, ready to give our all and more. Or else. "You guys don't want to be here?" he'd ask if just one person did not appear enthusiastic enough. "Get on the line." Get on the line. The four words we dreaded most. Those four words meant another form of running, as punishing as Cemetery Hill. We referred to it as 28s because of what we would have to do in 28 seconds or less. There was another term for it, suicides. In 28 seconds, we had to run from the baseline to the free throw line and back to the baseline. Then from the baseline to half court and back to the baseline. Follow me so far? Then to the far free throw line and back to the baseline. Then to the far baseline until you finally finish at the baseline where you started. In 28 seconds. Most of the guys were able to do it, but that wasn't enough to satisfy Coach Calhoun. Oh no. Everyone had to do it, or everyone would have to do it again. That was a problem for us due to Eric Hayward, our 6'7" forward. Eric was, to put it delicately, a bit on the deliberate side. Okay, slow. No way he could finish in 28 seconds. So to get out of the gym before the semester ended, we used to carry him across the line. We still didn't always make it in 28 seconds, but that was not the point.